Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. A new report indicates that the American Psychiatric Association has closed ranks with the New York Times and other media outlets to try to silence psychiatrists who are publicly critical of the stability of our stable genius president, Donald J. Trump. And I want to thank Ford Green, who introduced me to the idea of narcissistic supply, which led to our excellent interview with psychiatrist Justin Frank, the author of Trump on the Couch, just a few weeks back. He linked up to me this story, which appears at a website called madinamerica.com, and under the byline of Joshua Kendall, who has written widely about psychiatry. We learn that when Yale psychiatrist Bandy Lee published her book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president, that it led to an unprecedented effort by the American Psychiatric Association to marginalize the reporting, the observations made in the book, and to essentially help develop a media blackout of their concerns. So it opens with a discussion about how in October of 2017, when the book was just published, that Bandy Lee and one of her co-authors, James Gilligan from New York University, a professor of psychiatry, were invited to speak at Columbia University. And as they had a dinner before the evening event, Bandy Lee was advised by the organizer that the chairman at Columbia's Department of Psychiatry had been added as a speaker. And Bandy Lee's quoted, "We were never consulted about whether this change was okay with us." And then Lieberman, Jeffrey Lieberman, he shows up in a white lab coat. "That's something I haven't seen before or since," she said. Now, she's written a textbook on violence. She interned at Bellevue in New York, was chief resident at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she is a full professor at Yale. That detail becomes important in a minute. So after Bandy Lee and Gilligan, James Gilligan, gave their 20-minute talks in which they fleshed out the central argument of the book that Trump is not mentally fit to be president, the podium was given to Dr. Lieberman. And he spent 1 year as president of the American Psychiatric Association, but it was a while back. He compared the two speakers before him to Nazi and Soviet psychiatrists who relied on bogus diagnoses to punish enemies of the state. And then he invoked their violation of the Goldwater Rule. Now, this goes back to 1964. Goldwater lost in a right-wing run against LBJ, Lyndon Johnson. And in the course of that, he felt that he was slandered by a muckraking magazine called Fact. And in fact, later Goldwater won a libel suit against them. So this led the APA to create the Goldwater Rule, which is essentially that its members shall not make comments of a analytic or psychiatric nature on public figures, including elected officials, who they have not personally analyzed or met with. Now, of course, the rules of confidentiality would prevent them from saying anything about people they actually had met with. So this is a complete muzzle. And so the article unfolds and tells us that after that unusual event, that Lieberman continued his attacks. In a middle-of-the-night tweet in early 2018, he challenged Lee's expertise because he assumed she was only an assistant professor. And along with that demeaning comment, he expressed his agreement with a professor of psychiatry from Stanford that the Goldwater Rule needed to be bypassed in order to do something about Lee and the grave risks that she posed. And the article later explains that the grave risks were to federal funding of the universities where Lieberman and the unnamed Stanford professor were employed. And so this led to an editorial in the New York Times, op-eds in the Times and, I believe, in the Guardian, penned by Dr. Lieberman. And it was an orchestrated effort to stop Bandy Lee and others from talking about Trump's mental state publicly. So Dr. Lee says, in early January, my inbox had been flooded with invitations to appear on national TV, but that stopped almost immediately. And since then, dozens of TV producers have invited me to be on their shows, but have always ended up canceling at the last minute. Now, that is a remarkable effort to silence people, to protect a man who any observer without psychiatric credentials can see is unstable, is narcissistic, he is insecure to the extreme that he must pounce on any perceived critic. And there, at times, he displays what I would call, as an unschooled observer, paranoia. So Vice ran a piece under Dr. Lieberman's byline where he repeated the same comments. And so this is a very disturbing effort to prevent public commentary, and it continues to this day. And Dr. Lee notes that we're in the middle of a pandemic where he's acting erratically. He has failed to discharge his duties in a rational and stable way. He uses these briefings to attack his enemies, mostly in the media, but also China and the World Health Organization and anybody else he can use to divert attention from himself. And in addition, the APA has strengthened the Goldwater Rule in the new rendition. It publicly addresses media organizations calling for an end to psychiatrists providing professional opinions in the media about public figures whom they have not examined. Okay, and it extends to cable news. Well, What about 60 Minutes, huh? Books, social media. This is a very broad gag order. And so I turn to my favorite psychiatrist who has dealt with these issues. And you can hear my recent interview with Justin Frank. It's at peterbcollins.com. It's open. No subscription is required. And so I emailed him this morning and asked him for comment. He got right back to me. He said, I have a lot of experience with my books and the Goldwater Rule, but fear that the Trump book met with political pressure from both the APA as well as from Trump supporters themselves. Now, I'll explain this because I haven't mentioned it before. But Dr. Frank's book, Trump on the Couch, came out a full 6 months before I first interviewed him about it. And at the time, we're friendly, and his nickname is Justy. And I said, Justy, this is a failure of publicity. I'm on the Random House mailing list. I routinely get emails and, you know, publicity releases about books that I have no interest in. And they know that I interviewed you previously for Bush on the Couch and Obama on the Couch. And he didn't really make a big stink out of it at the time. But he did squeeze them to send me some books that I gave away to subscribers here. And so he goes on, my publisher, a branch of Random House, did not push the book after a brief push when it came out. They suddenly dropped the ball after the book was out for about 2 weeks with no explanation. It was dramatic, and I still can't find out why. All they say is there was a glut on the market, the book came out too late to sell. And that makes little sense to me, because the book is unique, different from all others, and ironically endorsed on the book jacket by Dr. Bandy Lee. He goes on, when I wrote the Bush book, I took a radical step as nobody before me did an intensive study of a sitting president. I was concerned for my profession more than myself, so I called the president of the APA about 5 weeks before publication in 2004 to let him know and to tell him that I don't want to do anything to harm our profession, which I adore in many ways. He said I was skating on thin ice, but appreciated the call, said he'd take it up with the APA publicity people. There was no negative feedback at all from them. But by that time, I resigned the organization just in case. I received several angry letters from other psychiatrists and replied that I'd be happy to discuss the book, but only after they read it first, and that was the last I heard from any of them. The book was well received, but the New York Times refused to review it. Ditto for the Washington Post. Now, they did list it on their bestsellers lists, but they wouldn't review it. He continues, what scared them, I don't know. They certainly review all kinds of books slandering John Kerry and later Hillary Clinton, and of course none was written by a psychoanalyst. More from Dr. Frank. The Obama book was different. Colleagues of mine didn't give me book parties because they didn't want to see Obama criticized. I said, look, I'm a psychoanalyst. They knew that, and some were even friends who had given me parties for Bush on the couch. And that analysis is not about attacking people, whether it be Bush or Obama. It is about trying to understand better who they are as people and how they might behave as presidents. So many colleagues saw psychoanalysis as a weapon somehow. I have never seen it that way. So I had smelled a rat in the way that Random House didn't promote Trump on the couch. Now we have the evidence to back up that hunch. And I'm disgusted by it. It is more critical than ever for professionals who can see right on their TV screens the unstable, obvious behavior of this man. And yet they are professionally silenced, using Nazi-era arguments, when in fact, they're the ones being subjected to Nazi-era tactics. It's just another facet of the devolution of free speech here in America. And the New York Times today has a report. They call it news analysis. They're saying that Trump's response to the pandemic reflects a long disregard for science. This is not directly related to psychoanalysis, obviously. But they cite, you know, the recent events when he went to Atlanta to the CDC, and he bragged, every one of these doctors said, how do you know so much about this? And Trump said, maybe I have a natural ability. He talked about his uncle, who had been a brainiac at MIT. But they conclude a disregard for scientific advice has been a defining characteristic of Trump's administration, from the EPA to leaving the Paris Climate Accords to his handling of the science of the coronavirus episode here. So yesterday, the stable genius, after promising not to do any more briefings because they were a waste of his time, he, of course, reversed himself. And it was back and forth throughout the day. I got a couple of different updates. It's on, it's off, it's on again. Peter Baker in the Times writes, to the surprise of exactly no one, Trump resumed his daily coronavirus news briefings on Monday, just 2 days after tweeting that they were not worth the time and effort, and just 2 hours after his own White House officially canceled the planned appearance. The lure of cameras in the Rose Garden proved too hard to resist. For a president who relishes the spotlight, spends hours a day watching television, including himself on TV, the idea of passing on this daily chance to get his message out turned to be untenable, despite his anger over the coverage. So he promoted his administration's record on responding to the pandemic, despite widespread criticism. He blamed China for not stopping the virus. This is just yesterday. Suggested he was open to suing states for imposing restrictions embraced by his own public health advisors. And predicted an incredible fourth quarter of economic growth. But, Baker writes, he largely avoided the sort of anger he had displayed in recent days, even for questions that would typically provoke a sharp response. And he even attempted a little empathy or compassion. He was asked if the guy, if he should be reelected after so many Americans died in a matter of weeks. He said, yeah, we've lost a lot of people. But if you look at what original projections were, 2.2 million, we're probably heading to 60,000, maybe 70,000. It's far too many. One person is too many for this. And I think we've made a lot of really good decisions. He had this moment of truthiness, but of course reverted to his characteristic self-aggrandizement. Then asked if people might try to inject some Clorox. He said, I can't imagine why. Asked if he took responsibility. He said, no, I don't. Next question. And of course, he'd been tweeting all weekend after, you know, pouting over the bad coverage and his decision to go into video exile. And Baker says, while not at his feistiest, Trump still flashed some of his usual bombast. So, the AP report is a little bit drier. They highlight that the alleged purpose of the briefing was for Trump to announce new testing guidelines for the virus. And even the dry prose of the Associated Press, which tries hard to be neutral. Quote, the administration unveiled a blueprint for states to scale up their testing in the coming week, a tacit admission that testing capacity and availability over the past 2 months have been lacking. Yeah. And then there's this odd report from Vox. Now, I know they try to be edgy. They have a point of view. But this is really weird because they framed their report on yesterday's performance by Trump. And they admit that they got it wrong. So he was asked a question about China, and he starts talking about the deficit. Now, maybe I've just gotten used to his bizarre syntax and his jumbled rhetoric. But I looked at the video clip of this, and he was clearly referring to the trade deficit, not the U.S. annual or long-term borrowing in red ink. So, quoting here, as part of his argument that he oversaw the development of the greatest economy in the world history prior to the coronavirus reaching U.S. shores and wrecking things, Trump claimed, if you look, prior to this virus, the deficit was coming down under my administration. He said this was due to him putting massive tariffs on China and that they resulted, quote, in taking in tens of billions of dollars from the country that he's now trying to blame for the pandemic. Now, they do expose his flat-out lie here. But in an update, in parentheses, they say, a reader pointed out that when Trump's reference to the deficit is read in context, he was responding to, it was about China. He may have been referring to the trade deficit specifically with China and not the national deficit. Duh! So this is yellow journalism. It approached this with a bias. Now, they are correct to expose that the tariffs do not take in tens of billions of dollars, and he piled on that lie saying that, you know, we parceled out some of that money to agribusiness because they were hurt by the trade war with China. But why on earth do they feel the need to lie about what he was clearly talking about, be forced into a retraction? I don't get it. I mean, this is the kind of thing that allows him to say fake news. And this is where irresponsible media creates this huge opening for him to tweet at his 60-plus million idiots that they lie about me, they mischaracterize me, and he gets to play the victim. So Vox also published, and I want to make clear that they published an op-ed that they are not responsible for the opinions and the point of view. But it's in response to the documentary film that I opened the podcast with yesterday called Planet of the Humans. And they feature a lengthy op-ed by an assistant professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, And she appears to be a climate scientist. Her name is Leah C. Stokes. And as I read this, I was struck that she is intentionally missing the point of the film. So the headline is a smear. Michael Moore produced a film about climate change that's a gift to big oil. Now, this film is a lament, much more than an indictment of the climate activists, the scientists who work on the issues, and those who I respect who've been trying to deal with a very complex set of issues. Driven by the industrial age, the spewing of carbon, and overconsumption by people like you and me. The subheadline, Planet of the Humans, deceives viewers about clean energy and climate activists. But I believe she intentionally fails to look at the big picture that Jeff Gibbs tries to define in his film. And that is that when you look at it, the systems end to end, all right, you can argue that electric cars and hybrids have sharply reduced tailpipe emissions. That, I believe, is a fact. But they take pot shots at Jeff Gibbs' movie by, for example, showing that a sequence where GM was debuting the Chevy Volt, which was almost 10 years ago, that he shamed the GM Flax into admitting that the electricity used to charge the car came from coal. Well, while there have been coal plants shut down and, you know, the clean coal lie has been spread in America, the bottom line is true. Your plug-in car relies on the renewable, you know, quotient or elements of the power grid that you're plugged into. And so a Tesla in Detroit, where they're still burning coal and they got mounds of coal ash right along the Detroit River downtown, that is not end-to-end a clear energy vehicle. And so by nitpicking, by being an armchair producer and trying to describe the movie that Jeff Gibbs should have made instead of the one that he did, by using straw man arguments, well, I find it really off-putting. And she says, as a scholar, I've done my fair share of research and writing on these issues over the past decade. Renewables have downsides, as do biomass, nuclear, hydropower, batteries, and transmission. There is no perfect solution to our energy challenges. But her recommendation is that Jeff Gibbs should have made the movie that she wanted. And so I just find this really an attack on the academic system, on the scientific model, and the thin-skinned nature of the people in the whole climate change milieu. And she correctly notes, the largest share of the movie's scorn goes to biomass, generally burning wood, which supplied less than 2% of the U.S. electricity mix last year. But the filmmakers obscure that fact, showing graphs that imply biomass is leading to forest destruction across the U.S. Well, that's not the movie I saw. Because what they did is quote a person who appears to be an expert, who said, look, if you burn down every tree in the United States, you could only use biomass to generate the power needed for the grid for 1 year. And they did put up a map that showed all the biomass facilities that have popped up across the country. And then she falsely says, when Gibbs questions environmental activists about biomass, they tell him it's complicated. No, they dodged the damn question from Bill McKibben to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to Van Jones. And I think one of them did actually say it's complicated, but that's not a sufficient answer when he points that out. Then our Santa Barbara professor admits biomass can be and often is done poorly with significant environmental harms. Scientists have raised concerns over the European Union's incentives for renewables, leading to wood being shipped from North America. So, I find this really frustrating. Then we get to defense of St. Bill McKibben. She says, watching this film, you might mistake him for a robber baron. And she claims that he has never taken any money for his environmental activism with 350.org. But in a video snippet that somebody else recorded in an interview with McKibben, he couldn't name any of his funders. He was fumbling about some Swedish foundation or something like that. And I'm sorry. I've worked at nonprofits, and you know where your money is coming from. Because the next grant is what you need to fund your project or fund your payroll. Now, this appears to be a fair claim. McKibben wrote to the filmmakers to clarify his views. They did not write back. And she quotes him, that seems like bad journalism and bad faith. Now, I'm not here to defend Jeff Gibbs and Michael Moore. But I saw the movie. I thought it was straightforward. And the kind of whataboutism, the reframing of the intent of the filmmaker to say, well, if the corporate capture of the environmental movement is the problem, it's puzzling why the film has almost nothing to say about corporations themselves. You know, the fossil fuel companies and electric utilities that lied about climate science for 30 years. That climate denial campaign is not mentioned. The film isn't about that. That's old news. The film is about the illusions that Jeff Gibbs argues have been created by the Sierra Club, by many leaders. And so I think that this criticism is an effort to circle the wagons, the green wagons, to defend people who seem to be so messianic that they're above criticism. And I'd love to hear Bill McKibben or RFK Jr. or Van Jones say, you know, maybe there is a little bit too much hype behind the Green New Deal. Maybe we do need to level with people that we haven't seen the growth in renewable energy so far that we'd like to. And that we haven't acknowledged the end-to-end costs in both money and carbon emissions that these so-called green energy sources are based on. Now, here's even more outrageous news. Some of the people who feel that they've been unfairly criticized in this film want it censored. They want it, according to this Guardian headline, taken down. So we have to preserve the green gospel by preventing people from hearing critical or contrary information? And this Guardian article misrepresents the film in many of the same ways that the Vox op-ed by Leah Stokes does. But we have Josh Fox, who exposed fracking with his important documentary Gasland, Michael Mann, a climate scientist. They all signed on to this letter, saying that they want the movie to be removed from circulation. And one outfit, Films for Action, an online library of videos, temporarily took the film down after describing it as full of misinformation. But then they put it back, saying they didn't want accusations of censorship to give the film more power and mystique than it deserves. Wow. This is intellectual dishonesty. And if it were just about, you know, trivial matters, I'd put it aside. But this is about trying to address serious climate change and the potential extinction of humans as soon as 10 or 15 years from now. And rather than accept the criticism and say, yeah, we need to level with people, And the twin themes of the film, the real takeaways, are that overconsumption and overpopulation are the issue. And it's either Stokes or another piece that I read. I have another critique of the film that I'm planning to comment on tomorrow. But let me see here. Oh, here it is. It is Stokes. She says, "The fact is that wealthy people in the developed world have the largest environmental footprints and the lowest birth rates. When this message is promoted, it's implying that poor people of color should have fewer children. Not to mention the fact that pushing population control is completely disrespectful of women's reproductive autonomy." Wow. None of that is suggested in the film. It's simply an observation that we've got too many people consuming too much shit, and that's what's choking the earth. And so we're not allowed to address overpopulation because it's disrespectful to a woman's right to choose, to reproduce. So then it becomes sexist, misogynist, and despicable because it demonizes poor people who have babies? I mean, these arguments are so insulting. Let me end on this note on this topic. Faith Peoples, one of our longest, most loyal podcast listeners and supporters here, emailed, "I watched this first thing this morning, right after I got my cup of coffee. Mind-blowing. I already knew much of this, that capitalism had co-opted environmentalism, even climate change. But to see in detail the fraud of green energy is profoundly demoralizing. Right now, I'm feeling hopeless. But I need more time to digest this. Thanks for sharing. Signed, Faith." There is other news today. Friday is International Workers' Day. And here in the United States, employees at Amazon, Instacart, Whole Foods, Walmart, Target, and FedEx are planning to walk out on work, citing their employers' record profits at the expense of workers' health and safety during the coronavirus pandemic. "We are acting in conjunction with workers at Amazon, Target, Instacart, and other companies for International Workers' Day to show solidarity with other essential workers in our struggle for better protections and benefits in the pandemic," said Daniel Steinbrook, a Whole Foods employee and a strike organizer. And an Amazon employee in Indiana has over the last month tallied COVID-19 cases at Amazon warehouses in the United States. There have been at least 500 in at least 125 Amazon facilities. And, of course, the reaction from the employers is, this is just being orchestrated by unions. And these are all virulently anti-union companies. And to its credit, the New York Times, which is not very good on labor issues, reported on a variety of companies that have used the pandemic as an excuse to bust unions. There is a furniture rental company called Court, owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. It laid off its truck drivers and replaced them with contractors to derail union organizing efforts. "They fired us because we tried to start a union," said Julio Perez, who worked in North Bergen, New Jersey, for Court. Nurses in North Carolina accused Mission Hospital, owned by HCA Healthcare, of using the pandemic to delay a union election. At Uovo Fine Arts, a company that packages and transports arts for wealthy individuals and galleries, workers said they were laid off as punishment for trying to unionize last year. Everline, the online clothing company, laid off much of its customer service team 4 days after a small number of its members informed the company's chief executive that they had enough support to form a union. It's called a card check. And the company that owns the Plain Dealer newspaper in Cleveland, as we have related here, laid off its union journalists and increased its reliance on non-unionized workers. And that's not all. David Trone, a Democratic congressman from Maryland — I've never heard of the bum. He's apparently a pretty rich guy, and he is an owner, or the owner, of Total Wine and More, the country's largest privately owned wine, beer, and liquor retailer, 206 stores in 24 states, described as a multi-billion-dollar company. And a few weeks back, he bumped up the pay, I'll call it combat pay, for his frontline employees by $2 an hour. It's chump change, but it's better than nothing. And now they've announced that they're not going to do that anymore because they want to preserve the financial health of the company so they can keep all these workers on the job. Only sales at their stores are at unprecedented highs. And despite having their bonus pay withdrawn, oh, they got a $25 gift card. They're still required to wear masks and gloves for health and safety purposes. So they have to maintain the precautions, but they don't get the pay linked to the same risks that they take. Last week, I was busting Florida for the report that only 4% of people who'd applied for unemployment had gotten a check for $237, which is the state maximum, or $837 if you get the federal bump in there. Well, I'm sorry to report that here in the Golden State, we've maxed out. Now, the numbers of employees who've applied is in the millions here, and it was below a million in Florida. But the services at the Employment Development Department have buckled under a lack of sufficient technology to support them. And we have had a lot of computer problems at the DMV and the EDD here in California. And this will be compounded because today is the date that they started accepting applications for unemployment benefits from self-employed and independent contractors. And I know somebody who filled out a form and tried to submit it at the EDD website this morning, and it bounced. I imagine that will continue. Two sides of Andrew Cuomo. It appears he has compassion fatigue because on his daily television performance, he held up a newspaper photo of homeless people camping on subway trains and said, "That is disgusting, what is happening on those subway cars. It's disrespectful to the essential workers who rely on the subway to get to work. It's not even safe for the homeless people," he said, "to be on trains. No face mask. You have this whole outbreak. We're concerned about homeless people. So we let them stay on the trains without protection in the epidemic of the COVID virus? No." So he clearly views them as second-class citizens, and they probably don't vote, so they're expendable to Andrew Cuomo. However, last week I criticized him for his omissions, for always focusing on the present and skillfully avoiding topics that, don't play well, just like Barack Obama has that skill. But today on his TV appearance, he said, "I wish someone had stood up and blew the bugle. And if no one was going to blow the bugle, I would feel much better if I was a bugle blower last December and January. I would feel better sitting here today saying, I blew the bugle about Wuhan province in January. I can't say that." Now, that's a pretty honest admission from a guy who I've never heard be self-critical before. So, let's give him points for that. Now to our daily COVID-19 update prepared by Linda Lewis. Some really good content in here today. First, the numbers. Worldwide confirmed reported cases, just over 3 million. 216,000 deaths in the United States. 1,008,000 cases confirmed and 58,126 deaths. And I think Linda heard some of my struggle with the data reports coming out of this pandemic. And let me quote from this quite liberally. She says, 3 months after the first coronavirus deaths, public health experts finally have some reasonably useful data. But what do they mean? That depends on how the data were collected, which data were selected for inclusion, and the expertise and agendas of those interpreting them. She cites Mark Twain. There are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. Figures often beguile me, he wrote, particularly when I have the arranging of them myself. So she goes on, within the U.S., data have produced a changing picture of coronavirus as gaps and errors have been detected. For example, The picture of coronavirus told by New York's confirmed COVID-19 death toll looks different when one compares the overall death toll, as reported yesterday in the New York Times. More than 27,000 New Yorkers have died since the start of the outbreak in March, 20,900 more than would be expected over this period, and thousands more than have been captured by official death statistics. As of Sunday, the city had attributed 16,673 deaths to coronavirus, either because people had tested positive or because the circumstances of their death led city health officials to believe the virus to be the most likely cause. But there remains a large gap between this number and the total deaths above typical levels in the last 6.5 weeks. More than 4,200 people whose deaths are not captured by the official coronavirus toll. The recent death count reached 6 times the normal number of deaths for the city at this time of year, a surge in deaths much larger than what could be attributed to normal seasonal variations from flu, heart disease, or other common causes. The city's largest mass casualty event in recent memory, September 11th, claimed only a fraction as many lives. And let me interject that people aren't driving, the gun crimes have dropped significantly, but not to zero. People are not getting medical attention. And this is just my own observation that at least, in amateur ways, anecdotal, that's the word I'm looking for, a lot of people die after they go into the hospital from sepsis and other infections that they pick up in the hospital. All right, returning to Linda's commentary, the Times published graphs showing similar disparities in the data collected by 12 countries. Those data sets reveal a need for caution in drawing conclusions from a data set. That difficulty is magnified when one tries to compare data sets from across the U.S. and around the world. How the numbers are collected, cultural acceptance of restrictions, demographics, testing rates, how long the virus was circulating, and other variables make broad comparisons risky. Nevertheless, some people seem determined to try, including Trump. In one example, Trump used data comparisons to further his anti-China agenda. Quote, do you really believe those numbers in this vast country called China? Does anybody really believe that? That's what he asked in a news briefing last Wednesday, why the U.S. has the highest numbers of official deaths and cases in the world. That assumption led to U.S. suspension of funding for the World Health Organization, a move that will have negative impacts for many poorer countries. Others look for evidence in coronavirus data that some mitigation measures are better than others. She says, thus, public health experts often point to past epidemics for lessons applicable to this current pandemic. And I want to thank our friend in Switzerland, Olivier de Merlu, who sent me a note. Peter, total morbidity statistics are independent of interpretation and or quality of COVID testing. The following table has total weekly deaths in Holland by age category. Note that in Holland, nobody's forced to stay inside. Schools will be reopening on the 11th of May. What you see in the table, and I did look at it, is that there is no appreciable increase in total morbidity, in the over 65-year-old age group. Oh, wait a minute, that's under 65. Increased morbidity is mostly concentrated in the 80-year-old plus category, where the peak in morbidity reached a max of about twice the rate of January and has come down last week. This would presumably explain the Italian hotspots, assuming that Italian old age was a factor. In turn, he says, he heard that the initial pessimistic United Kingdom computer models were based on Italian data, which would explain why they were pessimistic. Then he says that the Stanford antibody measurement is not out of line with Imperial College's computer estimate of accumulated infections. And he continues, in Holland, a large-scale measurement among 7,000 blood donors was made, which actually found antibodies in 3% of samples. They seem to have been aware of the risks of both false positives and false negatives. The false negatives were assessed using recovered individuals in which the illness had previously tested positive, and the false positives were assessed using blood samples from before corona times. They claim the test is not good enough to use for individual diagnosis, but good enough for a rough estimate of the antibody prevalence in the general population. So I think that's informed commentary, and I'm happy to share it with you. Now to issues that Linda has assembled here related to the food supply. I saw on Sunday, as she notes, a full-page ad published in newspapers and signed by the board chairman of Tyson Foods, John Tyson, warning that the food supply chain is breaking, that farmers will be left without anywhere to sell livestock and millions of animals, will be depopulated because of the closure of processing facilities. But Linda counters with this comment from Food and Water Watch. Is the closure of these slaughterhouses leaving us, as Smithfield claims, perilously close to the edge in terms of our meat supply? Nope, not at all. The truth is we have copious amounts of meat in cold storage around the country as a result of increased production, flat demand, and the Trump administration's trade war. And we already overproduce for the sake of export. Up to 30% of the pork processed in this country is destined for overseas markets. Corporate agriculture is stoking fears of food scarcity to pressure officials to allow them to reopen facilities quickly and to protect their bottom line. And Tyson in particular has been pressing for less regulation and appears to be using the current situation to try to get relaxation of some of those rules. And separately, we have a report that Linda sent after she filed her main report that Trump is apparently going to invoke the Defense Production Act to ensure that beef, pork, poultry, and eggplants keep running. But, of course, the incidence of positive testing for coronavirus in meat plants all across the Midwest is quite alarming. And so it appears that Trump will trade the health of those workers for an increase in deliveries, not necessarily production, but deliveries of these supplies. Separately, Linda notes that farmers are in distress, unable to get crops, milk, and livestock to market due to closure of businesses. Tens of millions of pounds of American-grown produce is rotting in fields as food banks scramble to meet a massive surge in demand, a two-pronged disaster that's deprived farmers of billions of dollars in revenue while millions of newly jobless Americans struggle to feed their families. And we also note the failure of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Back in March, industry leaders and lawmakers called on the USDA to step in by buying up the surplus and redistributing it to food banks. But it wasn't until around a month later that Trump directed USDA to launch its $19 billion coronavirus food assistance program. In addition, USDA waited until last Friday to announce that it's establishing a national incident coordination center to help farmers find markets for their livestock. Then she cites a report from March of last year from the Government Accountability Office examining USDA's ability to respond to a major outbreak of another highly infectious virus. And the GAO reported, in a large outbreak, millions of cattle could be affected, disposing of the carcasses of a 50,000-head herd of cattle from a large feedlot would be a massive effort. The total weight for disposal could be as much as 30,000 tons, or about 1,500 dump truck loads to move all of the carcasses to disposal sites. So we do have issues, but it appears that, like so many other greedster industries, they are gaming this pandemic crisis to advance their self-interest. And finally, Linda reports that there are 15 states that have made some move to relax restrictions: Alaska, Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Iowa, Kentucky, Minnesota, Mississippi, Montana, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and West Virginia. While in Massachusetts, the Republican Governor Charlie Baker has announced he is extending the restrictions until at least May 18th. And here in California, where we have a lower rate of outbreak except for Los Angeles metro area, Governor Newsom has announced that the extension of the restrictions will continue. That is also endorsed by the county health leaders who were the first to impose restrictions here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thanks to Linda for her work every day to help me with this important element of our podcast. So Jennifer Rubin is this opinion writer at the Washington Post. I dubbed her the person running the Stop Bernie desk, and she's been reassigned to monitor Mitch McConnell. And she reports that after McConnell got hammered for his refusal to provide bailouts for the states and said that they should declare bankruptcy, he is now backpedaling. He figured out that he's not going to get very far. So what he said was that I'm open to additional assistance. It's not just going to be a check, though. You get my point? We're not writing a check to send down to states to allow them to, in effect, finance mistakes they've made unrelated to the coronavirus. Well, let's just take a look at Kentucky. Because David Sirota did the digging. And the big issue in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's home state, is that they rank number 50 of the 50 states in funding for their pension obligations. They owe $42 billion, and when you compare that to the population of bigger states, well, they've got a bigger problem. And it turns out that Trump states, 12 of the worst funded pension systems in the country, are red states. Kentucky, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, Arizona, North Dakota, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan, Alaska, Kansas, Alabama, and Montana. Well, the corporate greedsters really have ways with this administration, because you know that some of the bailout money is coming from congressional authorizations. That would be the Paycheck Protection Program. But they also funneled money into the Federal Reserve, which is loaning it, and it does have to be paid back, to big companies. But the Federal Reserve has done an end run so that the restrictions that Congress tried to impose on all of the money, that it couldn't be used for executive pay or for stock buybacks, things of that sort, layoffs of the workforce, well, the way it was all maneuvered in the end is that the money coming from the Fed has no such restrictions. And For example, the $46 billion program for airlines does have limits on dividends and limits on executive pay. And its requirement on retaining employment is more rigorous. But, I believe the Democrats are responsible for this error. But in the Paycheck Protection Act, or program, it puts companies that have already laid off their workers in a bind, because they may not be able to get their loans forgiven. Because, for example, if you're a restaurant, you had 50 employees, and now you're allowed to reopen, but you can only have 25% of the patrons at any given time, well, you're not going to be able to rehire everybody. And so there are serious issues about whether the forgiveness of those loans will ever occur. So Trump Co. has been embarrassed, and many companies, including the Los Angeles Lakers, that got part of the free money from Washington, they are returning it. Auto Nation returning $77 million. The Penske Automotive Group, we've got one of their outlets here, $66 million. Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, $20 million. You get the picture. But it really never stops, because there are companies like cruise ship and hotel firms that have said, no, we're keeping the money. Now, some of them may have met the terms and kept employees on the payroll, but it sticks in my craw that this one outfit that features the Republican donor Monty Bennett, a Dallas executive, he is refusing to return the bailout money that in part is being used to prop up the Ritz-Carlton St. Thomas. That's just plain disgusting, isn't it? Also disgusting is that FreedomWorks, the lobby group in Washington that gets a lot of money from the Koch family, it's not just the two brothers anymore, one of them died, they put in a request for $300,000. They just have no shame. A fact-checker article at the Washington Post yesterday shows that Trump's claim that the Postal Service is losing money on the packages shipped on behalf of Amazon and Jeff Bezos, the owner of the fact-checking newspaper here. No conflict of interest, you know that. Anyway, it shows that when you split the first-class mail that the Postal Service is required by law to deliver for a flat rate anywhere in the country, when you compare that with the packages that they ship, shipping and packages is generating what we would call profits, excess revenue, and it has for the last 3 years. And so when Trump claims that they need to jack up the rates on Amazon by 4X, well, it's simply not true. It doesn't pencil out. It's just based on his hatred for Jeff Bezos. So here's a piece from the Guardian newspaper that was forwarded to me by my longtime ally, Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media at New York University. And before we get to the article, he prefaced it with this comment. The article tells us two things, that the FBI now functions as Big Pharma's national police force, and that this means war, not just against those who categorically reject vaccination, but against the far larger mass of those who categorically reject any particular vaccination, like MMR, Gardasil, or flu shots. He says the main point here is that this means war. Well, Mark, I respectfully disagree, and I think you've lost your bearings. Because as I read this article, which is about an FBI foundation that got a couple of people to write a report, a research paper, over a year ago, and they concluded on a speculative basis, in my view, that America's anti-vaxxer movement would pose a threat to national security in the event of a pandemic with a novel organism. Now, as I say, this is a report from a year ago, and I regard it as business as usual, not war. And basically, they do smear the anti-vaxxer movement, and they lump all people who have concerns about vaccine safety into one group of crazy idiots. And The Guardian falsely reports here, let me read the quote, "Since the virus hit America, anti-vaccination activists and some sympathetic legislators around the country have led or participated in protests against stay-at-home orders. Now, in my reading of the news, I've seen a report on one woman in Idaho." And that becomes every person who is concerned about being forced to submit to vaccination or to vaccinate their children under penalty of the law. And later in the article, a good quote from Mike German. He's the former FBI agent over at the Brennan Center. He said he was worried about the unintended consequences of defining a group as a national security threat based on their beliefs and how that might feed into both policy and law enforcement decisions. Quote, "You can imagine some young police officer who's trying to do a good job protecting his or her community, and all of a sudden he's told that anti-vaxxers are Russian agents." German added that the lack of proper government preparation and stockpiles of medical materials is a much more serious problem than the influence of a relatively small group of anti-vaxxers ever could be. But it is hard to argue with the need for a science-based policy approach. I emailed Mike to commend him on his rational thinking. So yesterday, in detail, I reported to you on the Business Insider's disclosure and naming of two additional women who support the allegations of Tara Reid because she told them that Joe Biden had sexually assaulted her before she left her job as a staff member of Senator Biden's office. So the Washington Post today, in what appears to be just going through the motions, published an AP report which basically parallels the Business Insider report. But the smart person at Reddit captured the first headline for this article that was on the website. So let me read the way I found it later today. Report: Biden accuser spoke to neighbor of alleged assault. That's accurate. That's not inflammatory. The previous headline, when the story was posted last night: Trump allies highlight new claims regarding allegations against Biden. Now, it's true that Trump allies are doing that, but that positions the whole buttressing of Tara Reid's claims by two witnesses in the past and turns it into a Trump story. That is yellow journalism. Also, a sharp-eyed Reddit reader discovered and posted that CNN has removed the archive video of the Larry King show from August 11th, 1993, where Tara Reid's mother called in, and even though she wasn't named, she asked what could happen because her daughter had a complaint against a public official and it wasn't taken seriously. Nice going, CNN. Whose side are you on? Also, I want to commend to your reading the publication of a letter from whistleblowers at the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It's published today with an editor's note from Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté at the Gray Zone Project. And what the whistleblowers say is that the latest report alleging that in March 24th, 25th, and 30th of 2017, in the Syrian town of Tamena, it's got a capital L at the beginning, but I think that's silent, L-T-A-M-E-N-A, that the whistleblowers say that their superiors simply created a report without sending anybody into the field to investigate and said that sarin had been used in these attacks by the Syrian military under the dictator Bashar al-Assad. And the report is that they dropped a couple of sarin bombs on fields, agricultural lands in the middle of nowhere. Now, this follows the reports that were highly contested and whistleblowers exposed, the shifting of their field reports into a politicized report that blamed Syria for using chemical weapons in Douma of April 2018, and there is a pattern there. So I think you should check it out if you're open-minded and critical of the way Syria, and I make no excuses for Syria, it's a brutal government there, but we are supposed to just take these reports hook, line, and sinker. And I'm glad that Blumenthal and Maté are putting forward efforts to expose the truth. In Brazil, as Pepe Escobar reported to us in our great interview posted last Friday, Jair Bolsonaro is facing an investigation. Now, Sergio Moro, the justice minister who quit after running the car wash investigation that Glenn Greenwald has shown to have been highly political, and that led to the jailing of Lula da Silva and the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. Well, now Bolsonaro is facing possible impeachment. There's an investigation by the Supreme Federal Court in Brazil into the allegations made by Sergio Moro on his way out the door that he had several conversations, apparently has email exchanges with Bolsonaro, that he wanted to handpick the head of the federal police who would give him reports on his political opponents. The Pentagon today released three declassified videos that show U.S. Navy pilots encountering UFOs. Now, a UFO is not necessarily from an alien territory, because UFO just means unidentified flying object. But these are objects that we've never seen before, winging around in the air. And I'm open to full disclosure of whatever our government knows about UFOs. And finally, on a lighter note today, I have linked to a fake news article. It's real fake news in the Babylon Bee. And the headline reads, "Inspiring. Celebrities spell out we're all in this together with their yachts." Now, I'm a sailor, and some people think that the boat that I own with partners is a yacht. I don't quite see it that way. But they put together a fake photo of boats that are lined up to spell out we're all in this together. And their phony report quotes Ellen DeGeneres saying, "We're just like you." She said on Instagram as her servant sailed her yacht into position to form the apostrophe, "Yes, maybe I have a yacht, and you've only ever been on the storybook canal boats at Disneyland. But still, it's pretty much the same thing." And then they hammer Patton Oswalt, "Stay home, save lives. It's not that hard. Look, poor people, it's not worth risking your life just to go to Fuddruckers or work a job or whatever it is you peasants do all day." Thanks for listening all the way to the end of this lengthy news and comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.